Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. This morning, correspondent Tom Bonsey takes a look at the question of water recharging. It's part of the plan for the future to stabilize water supplies in the West. In the second half of the show, KLCC's Jacob Lewin has a two-part report on Oregon's poor ranking nationally for high school graduation. Oregon was up 47th from 49th, but why so low? But first, we take a look at changes in SNAP benefits occurring April 1st. The changes could dramatically affect citizens in Oregon and Washington. Starting April 1st, 15,000 Washington residents could lose benefits under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program if they do not meet a work requirement. The requirement applies to people ages 18 to 49 who are unemployed, able-bodied, and without dependents. During a recession, a waiver had been in place that allowed them to receive extended benefits, but with employment improving, many counties no longer qualify. Nora West of the Washington State Department of Social and Health Services explains the requirements needed to maintain the benefit.
They could work at least 20 hours per week or 80 hours a month average, or complete at least 16 hours of unpaid volunteer work.
The counties affected are King, Snohomish, and parts of Pierce. New recipients in the able-bodied category will only be eligible for 3 months of benefits over a three-year period. After that, the work requirements kick in. Catherine Ryan of Food Lifeline, an organization that helps distribute goods to Washington food banks, says Washington State is a leader in job and education programs for people who receive food assistance.
In some ways, we are lucky here that I think fewer people are going to be affected than are in other places. There are other states that don't even have those programs in place, so it's like that's not even an option for people.
As many as 12,000 Oregonians in two counties are in a similar situation, also beginning April 1st. Unemployed, able-bodied individuals without dependents, again ages 18 through 49 in Multnomah and Washington counties, will no longer be covered by extended benefits. Belit Burke, manager of the SNAP program, is notifying Oregonians in danger of losing the benefits at the end of the month.
We're trying in two different levels to help them meet the exemption criteria if they do, and help them also know about the employment and training opportunities that are available to them to help them get to work if that's something that they're ready to do.
If individuals work for 80 hours a month, they can continue to receive benefits. The Department of Human Services is offering job training and apprentice programs to help people meet the work requirement. Jeff Clean of Oregon Food Bank is hoping his organization can fill the gap for people who lose the benefit.
We fully expect that they will be turning to the Oregon Food Bank network for assistance when, on average, they're going to lose about $190 a month in SNAP benefits. That's far more than we can make up, but we'll certainly do our best.
Clean says it's important to remember that the program reaches a lot of people in Oregon. About one in five receive food benefits. This is the Congress's third cut to the program in the last 2 years. Across the West, groundwater reserves are being depleted. Nature can't replenish the aquifers as quickly as they're being drawn down for irrigation, industry, and drinking water. But what if, through human ingenuity, we could put large volumes of water back underground at relatively low cost? Irrigators and the state of Idaho are making the most ambitious efforts yet in the Northwest to do so, and correspondent Tom Bonsey shows us how.
Irrigation season has not yet arrived. The potato, sugar beet, and barley fields of southern Idaho haven't sprouted. Yet the Milner-Gooding Irrigation Canal is brimming with water. It's nearly all spilling out of a gate and flume into a low spot in the desert, creating a temporary lake with the unromantic name of Milepost 31 recharge site.
Yeah, we're about a day or a day and a half that this water's traveled from the Snake River to get to here.
Brian Olmsted manages the Twin Falls Canal Company, an irrigation water provider in the area.
And it goes out into this recharge lake and then filters down through the lava rock, which is just what nature would do. When this area is covered with snow and it all melts, it all goes down into the aquifer.
The object is to stabilize the water supply under Idaho's most productive farming region. The aquifer stretches thousands of square miles from the Teton foothills past Idaho Falls, Pocatello, and Twin Falls to about Glens Ferry.
The Eastern Snake Plain Aquifer is also the sole source drinking water aquifer for at least a couple hundred thousand people, maybe more than that. So having that aquifer going down was bad for everybody in the state, really.
This infiltration basin is the biggest aquifer replenishment project among many planned in southern Idaho. The state is also paying irrigation companies to run water down unlined canals and ditches, which would normally be dry during farming's off-season. That's another low-tech, fairly cheap way to let the water just seep and infiltrate down. The state of Idaho and private partners have set a goal to triple the current amount of artificial groundwater recharge. Imagine flooding a college football field to the press box level 1,600 times. That's how much water they're talking about. The plan also entails curtailing water use by some farmers to take pressure off the aquifer. Olmsted says one of the challenges of putting water back underground is preventing the introduction of impurities.
Lava rock's a real good filter, so there's at least three monitoring wells around this site that monitor the groundwater to make sure that there's no contamination.
Idaho's governor and legislature have committed $16 million for new infrastructure and planning for water sustainability statewide, much of which will flow to the Eastern Snake Plain Aquifer. Speaker of the Idaho House, Scott Betke, says Northwest states have some advantages over other places coping with dwindling groundwater.
We're not like some of these other states, including California, Nebraska, Kansas, because we have ample water that, on average, leaves the state each and every year.
Specifically, surplus river water in late fall, winter, and spring that flows into Washington.
If that were put into the aquifer and not allowed to leave the state, we could fix this problem, and that's our intention.
In southern and eastern Idaho, the state has around 20 different projects in design, construction, or under evaluation to replenish the subterranean aquifer. Other basins around the northwest are ramping up too. For example, in the Walla Walla River Valley, on both sides of the Oregon-Washington border, Stephen Patton leads the aquifer recharge program at the Walla Walla Basin Watershed Council. He says the goal in his area is to revive springs and improve stream flows for endangered fish.
It's different than a lot of aquifer recharge programs in that we're putting it into the system for the regional benefit, for environmental flows, and for ecological improvement.
The techniques here include diverting high flows in winter and spring from the Walla Walla River into man-made ponds where the water can soak into the ground. This project has also buried a series of perforated pipes 6 or 7 feet underground to create what it calls infiltration galleries. Patton says his group plans to open more sites to almost double the amount of water pushed underground over the next 2 years. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
Patton says the WWBWC is currently operating 5 infiltration sites on the Oregon side of the state line and 4 on the Washington side that together recharge about 7,500 acre-feet per year. By opening more sites over the next 2 years, their long-term goal is to eventually get to about 25,000 acre-feet per year. The long-term number would stabilize the entire Walla Walla aquifer, allowing recovery to begin. Near Hermiston, Oregon, the County Line Water Improvement District has used seasonal high flows from the Umatilla River for groundwater recharge since the 1970s. It diverts river water into an unlined canal which allows the water to seep into a shallow aquifer from which it can later be pumped for irrigation. According to the Oregon Water Resources Department, the County Line District recharges an average of 6,000 to 7,000 acre-feet per year. Aquifer Recharge is just getting started in the Sequim Dungeness Valley in northwest Washington. The key objective there is to raise the water table to support fish survival in the Dungeness River. You're listening to The Bridge. In the second half of this edition, we have a two-part report from correspondent Jacob Lewin. More than one in four of Oregon's high school students don't graduate, or at least don't graduate on time. The U.S. Department of Education ranks the state 47th, although that's up from 49th a year ago. The first part in an ongoing series on this issue examines why the rate is so low and what a school in Corvallis is doing to help change that.
Good morning, CHS. This is Avery Allen with your morning announcements.
Here at Corvallis High School, you'll find kids like Dylan B.A. Dylan struggled when he got here as a freshman. In middle school, he had no social life and was sick a lot, so making friends became a priority.
We would always hang out. Then we'd start skipping class. It was like, I'm behind in my class, so why should I go? I don't feel like I could get caught up in time to be able to pass, so what's the point in going?
A study by the Chalkboard Project shows one quarter of Oregon students are chronically absent, and even more don't graduate from high school in 4 years.
It is stunning to us to see the correlation with missing 10 days or more and the impact on the high school completion.
The Chalkboard Project's Dan Jameson. John Taponia, president of Echo Northwest, a consulting firm, sees a cultural connection between the high absenteeism rate and the low graduation rate. He says Oregon may not have what he calls a culture of completion.
We are in the West. It is sort of a live and let live environment.
If Oregon were a person, it would be a type B, not a type A. States like Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana have higher graduation rates. Yet Taponia thinks Oregon offers a better education than those states.
The achievement scores that we see, for example, on national tests in eighth grade, where Oregon really is just solidly average. If you had to pick the average of average states and yet follow those same kids 4 years into the future, you see us fall way to the bottom. There's just a real disconnect there.
When he took over at Corvallis High School, which has a relatively high number of disadvantaged kids, Principal Matt Boring brought a personal perspective to bear.
I have a unique situation as a father. My daughter, Emily, is a sophomore at Yale University, and my son, Aaron, is in the life skills program here at Corvallis High School, a junior. You know, you have an Ivy Leaguer and a kid who can't read or write.
When he got here 5 years ago, Boring was appalled at the school's 70% graduation rate. He focused on the kids who were struggling, partly by changing the schedules of his teachers.
Putting the most passionate teachers in front of those kids, educating not just the easy kids, the kids who come to school ready.
Trying not to shortchange the more successful students, Boring makes sure his best teachers take on advanced placement classes as well as the neediest kids. He also personally nabs underachievers in the hall all the time.
Hey, Jordan.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your 24% in American Lit.
Uh-huh.
How'd you get it so low?
I got kind of behind. There's some stuff going on, you know, outside.
Oregon's unique Latino situation also impacts our graduation rate. A high percentage of Oregon Latinos arrived here in the 90s, mostly farm workers with little education and little English. Their kids are now high school aged. Kids whose parents are poor and relatively uneducated are more likely to have problems in school. As with other districts, Corvallis has pressed hard to expand its English language learners program.
Okay. Entonces, ¿qué es lo que tiene Lucho de la novela?
Partly due to ELL and acculturation,
sí, gracias, Julissa.
The Latino graduation rate has improved significantly, and that's expected to continue. But that will hardly solve all of our problems. Dan Jameson of Chalkboard says the low graduation rate cuts across all demographics.
We have the poorest high school completion for white students probably in the nation.
But Dylan B.A. and his friends probably will graduate. One of those teachers, who now see a range of students, showed confidence and lit a fire under them.
We stayed every day after school tutoring, and I was like, dang, I can do this. I know I can graduate.
Corvallis High has gone from that 70% graduation rate to better than 85%.
It doesn't seem to make sense, does it? Oregon students get average scores on national tests, but rank near the bottom in high school graduation rates. In fact, over 1 in 4 Oregon high school students don't graduate within the usual 4-year period. In part 2 of his look at this issue, correspondent Jacob Lewin takes us to David Douglas High School in Southeast Portland.
Zahra Walia.
Here.
Mohammed Jelani. Amal Mohammed.
It's roll call.
Sabrina Sharif.
At the Somali Club after school at Oregon's biggest high school, David Douglas, in outer Southeast Portland. David Douglas students and their families speak a total of more than 40 languages. 3/4 of the kids are economically disadvantaged, yet the school has a graduation rate slightly higher than the state average and is improving rapidly. Principal John Byer says there's been a big effort to curb absenteeism.
We have 5 or 6 AmeriCorps volunteers that do nothing but call students. We do home visits.
When 3 o'clock comes along, many of the 3,000 students don't go home, but head for the tutoring center or after-school language or enrichment classes. Some of their parents join them for classes. And there's a major federally funded summer program.
As much as you can connect kids back somehow to the school, not just within classes, sort of widens that net with an adult that they know, the better off you are with students when they get back in the classroom.
But when students come to Oregon as teenagers from, say, Somalia, with no English and no formal education, it may not be reasonable to expect them to graduate in 4 years. Social service worker Selena Ponce.
We had a 16-year-old student from Somalia who did not know what a pencil was. She did not have the dexterity or the ability to then write.
Even the best prepared students are facing more pressure than ever, according to mental health counselors. Corvallis High has improved its graduation rate from 70 to 90% over 5 years. Taking note of a cluster of suicides, 6 students in Corvallis, nearby Philomath and Albany, have taken their lives since 2010. Corvallis put 2 mental health counselors at the school in a partnership with Trillium Family Services. Counselor Diana Borough-Boswell says some of the pressure comes from shunning and shaming on social media.
Somebody used the acronym KYS, and I was like, "What? What is that?" And they said, "Oh, it means kill yourself." This is something students will say to each other on social media. Oh, KYS. Shut up. We don't want to hear from you. That's something I never could have imagined hearing from another student when I was in high school.
But Borough-Boswell says that's not the main mental health problem at Corvallis High. Bigger is students dealing with the trauma of homelessness, foster care, and parents with addictions. Borough-Boswell says problems that can lead kids to drop out or to the brink of dropping out cut across income lines.
Corvallis is an incredibly high-achieving town. It's one of the most educated cities in the United States. So if you look at students who feel like it's either perfection or they shouldn't bother, then that adds an incredible amount of pressure to them.
Navigating Corvallis' mental health system is rough when the psychiatrists have 6-month waiting lists.
Lily Shellhammer graduated 2 years ago, but after 2 years of severe depression, during which she'd missed school for weeks at a time.
Both of my parents are very successful and are in academics. There's a lot of pressure to continue in that path and get into the best college and do phenomenally in all my classes. So when I wasn't doing quite as well because of biological changes, then that took more of a toll because I felt that my self-worth had gone down because I was no longer able to perform at the level that was expected of my peers and my parents and some teachers.
A Pew study shows 55% of parents fear their kids are or will be struggling with anxiety and depression. In 2008, Oregon education officials decided to phase in tougher graduation requirements, such as 3 years of math, including Algebra 2 or equivalent.
We have high standards, and I think that's a good thing.
Hannah Vandering leads the Oregon Education Association, the state's largest public education employees union.
We have to look at how we support the students in order to reach those standards, not just raise the standards and pretend that we're going to be able to get there.
Relatively tough graduation requirements are one reason Oregon is near the bottom in the national graduation rate rankings. California, for example, offers a college prep and a non-college prep diploma, and that's why it beats Oregon. Vandering says another reason is the higher-than-average level of child hunger.
This is huge in Oregon. We have students who are not completing school because they're going to work, because their families can't afford to put food on the table or a roof over their heads.
It all leads to a graduation rate ranking of 47th nationally. State education officials and Governor Kate Brown are now making an improvement in the graduation rate a top priority. In Portland, I'm Jacob Lewin.
That's all the time we have for on this edition of The Bridge. Our thanks to correspondents Jacob Lewin and Tom Bontsey. And our thanks to you for listening and supporting Coast Community Radio's recent pledge drive. We couldn't do it without you. Send your comments and questions to News 1, that's NEWS and the numeral 1, to KMUN.org. And you can like us on Facebook. I'm Kate Brister. See you next week on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.